So Nancy very kindly invited me to provide an Anglo-Saxon perspective on this whole issue of technology as a tool of conversion. And as Niall's already mentioned, I'm going to be largely drawing upon Kentish evidence for this, particularly drawing upon my current excavations at Liminge. But what I thought I wanted to start with is just by thinking about some broader issues of, I guess, the inbuilt capacity, certainly the way that historians have thought about the inbuilt capacity of monasteries, obviously the institutions that spearheaded the Anglo-Saxon conversion. What gave these places a head start, if you like, in the whole process of rural intensification? And obviously, we've got various categories here. Labour force might be one, a large number of sort of bond tenants. We've also got aspects of landholding and stability in relation to that landholding that might distinguish monastic institutions from other landholders at the time. There's also the idea that monasteries exploited their inlands in peculiar ways. Thomas has already mentioned in relation to Irish institutions the importance of rural agriculture, agrarian regime. And one of the interesting ideas is that there's an emphasis in terms of running of monastic estates on agriculture, a heavily exploited inland to produce agricultural surplus as a form of income that's distinct from cash and commuted food rents, perhaps more particular to royal landholders. We've also got a fundamental to this whole sort of, regime of rural exploitation is the importance of those outfield dependencies, the limbs that we find providing particular resources, Ros Faith's expression, an archipelago of rights to tribute. So we've got all these various sort of economic kind of aspects here. I guess less prominent in the literature is to what extent ideology is playing a role here. Christianisation investing new meanings in the natural world and its resources, and that really being part and parcel of some of the economic shifts that we see happening at this period. I guess one of the things that I take from the previous literature on this whole topic is this whole idea of dynamics in rural intensification. Again, I'm drawing on Ross Faith's work here, where she poses this very interesting question that I think is fundamental. To what extent did the structure of early royal estates influence the economy of minsters endowed from them? Basically, what we're looking at here are aspects of continuity and change. Obviously, monasteries were tapped into pre-existing supply networks, particularly those customary food renders. So that's embedded within the nature of and workings of rural estates. And they work within the same environmental and landscape constraints as well. They were placed in similar landscape and with similar resource potential. But then we've got this dynamic introduced, the ones that I mentioned in the previous slide. New patterns of consumption, new forms of land management and rural exploitation. And with this added dimension that I just raised, this difficult one to actually approach archaeologically, these changed Christianized perceptions of the natural world. A quick evaluation of what work's been done in the Anglo-Saxon sphere in relation to the technology of rural production, or production more generally. If you look at the work that's been done, most of the emphasis has been on one particular type of technology, i.e. the technology of craft production, which is kind of what comes right at the end of the process, of course. These are the sort of materials, in many cases, that are being acquired or bought off the back of rural surpluses. So we know a reasonable amount about sort of the craft technology aspect. Much less well known from an Anglo-Saxon context is the technology of rural production. We've been provided with some glimpses, and I just show you one of those glimpses from the site of Hodden in Northumbria, where we've got these remarkable grain drying structures right at on the boundary of the monastic compound. But that's quite a rarity. And this relates to some inherent weaknesses in terms of the data that exists for monastic archaeology of pre-Viking period, the fact that much of it has been on the core buildings of monastic complexes. We've also got geographic bias. We've got problems even when we have been able to sample in precincts of documented monastic communities. Often it's the case that the level of sampling undertaken hasn't been consistent. For example, sieving is absolutely crucial for the recovery of fishbone. I'll be talking about that later. That often doesn't happen in the long kind of periods of investigation that we get associated with better known institutions. And we have a particular poor conception of that dynamic aspect that I mentioned. What impact? How can we begin to see the impacts of monastic foundation upon the rural scene? So that's how I would evaluate that sort of problems in current understanding. So I just want to focus down next and look at Kent and see what kind of perspectives it can offer. And I think one of the first things to say about it is for pre-Viking England, it's particularly well documented, particularly for the 7th and 8th centuries. We've got some good charter sources containing some very interesting and important economic detail that I'll be just showing you, talking you through briefly. We can map the church relatively easily in this area, certainly in terms of the larger institutions. We can characterise the church. And one of the interesting things that we can see particularly clearly is the emplacement of monasteries in what already was a stable network of royal vills. Places like Limmingen is one of these places, but there are others, Dover, Folkestone, Minster and Sheppey, and so forth. So what that means, in other words, is we can get insights into this dynamic phenomenon. We can see places changing over time. We can see diachronic developments. And that's one of the key contributions, I think, that Limmingen can make to these debates. So if you look at the charter sources, what kind of details do they provide for Kent? Well, particularly important is in long-distance trade. Susan Kelly's examined the toll remission charters for places like Minster and Sheppey, actively involved in those trading routes. In terms of land management, what we see in terms of the charters is the importance of outlying estates on Romney Marsh and Salt Marsh locations, and also the Weald for particular resources, salt production, fishing, iron industry, and so forth. Also some interesting snippets on the consolidation of estates. So we hear about Archbishop Wilfrid in this case. He gathered small land units together and formed them into one estate closed by a single boundary fence. So there's clearly consolidation of rural estates happening alongside this as well. As I mentioned in relation to the national scene, really the archaeological potential of Kent's monastic settlements has been underexploited, characterised by the keyhole glimpses, the emphasis on core buildings. We actually know very little about the nature of monastic life and the monastic economy. We just haven't targeted precincts in a systematic way. So in spite of its excellent documentary record, despite of its wonderful ecclesiastical heritage, we actually know remarkably little about how these sites functioned on a day-to-day basis. And that's where Limmingen comes in. A well-known site, I've mentioned it previously in relation to the documentary sources. We're now in the second year of an AHRC-funded phase of excavation, which is focusing on this very large village green area that's sort of in low-lying area beneath the chalk escarpment capped by the parish church. Excavations there in the 1850s and 60s by this man here, Canon Jenkins, recovered portions of the core buildings of the monastic complex. And I don't have time to go into the details of those, but you've got a nice 7th century Minster church immediately to the south of the standing medieval parish church. And it's a site that he chose to associate with Queen Ethelberga, the daughter of King Ethelbert of Kent, and also widow of King Edward of Northumbria. There are problems with that identification. It's more likely that this was a double house, a double monastery found somewhat later in the 7th century, but I don't want to go into the intricacies of that debate. Five seasons of open area excavation have been completed in open areas clustered around the historic churchyard. And basically, what we've produced in that work is a wonderful sequence. We have two distinct settlement foci, an early Anglo-Saxon one dating between the late 5th and early 7th century, which lies in the lower portions of the village. And that culminates, that early Anglo-Saxon activity, in the establishment of a royal complex, including high-status halls. We then get a localised Middle Saxon shift, pretty much coeval with when the documents are telling us that a monastery is founded in Liminge. Everything shifts up to the eminence, which is now capped by the medieval church. In other words, what we have is a microcosm for investigating the social dynamics of monastic foundation and Christianisation in an area that was absolutely fundamental to the earliest stages of the Anglo-Saxon conversion. So that's just some of the archaeology from the early Anglo-Saxon settlement focus. Sunken featured buildings, classic migration period archaeology dating, predominantly to the later 5th and 6th centuries, culminating in the construction of this building here, a 22-metre-long assembly hall, the type that we know from places like Yevering and Cowdrey's Down. I haven't got the time to go into the details, with lots of high-status indicators, vessel glass, objects of social display like this harness mount, and so forth. But what's really interesting is this is relatively short-lived. This is circa 600 AD, by the way. There's a decisive rupture in the settlement pattern around about the time of the foundation of the monastery. Everything shifts up onto the eminence that overlooks that earlier site. There's the church, the parish church, and we're in a dense array of Middle Saxon, later 7th through to 9th century occupation that's zoned. It has definite planning in this phase. Nice boundary ditches. We have a domestic zone, and we have outlying craft activity and economic zones as well. I think there's a tendency when looking at this whole subject maybe to underestimate, the degree of economic sophistication that always pre-existed in the landscape before monasteries came along. And this is a very good, I think, example of that. The coulter that Niall mentioned, it's scientifically dated to around about 600 AD, contemporary with our major royal hall, but it's in the pre-monastic complex. It was fished out the bottom of a sunken featured building. It has excellent Merovingian parallels and suggests that there was sophisticated rural infrastructure in Kent at this time that was influenced by its strong Frankish continental contacts. So that was already there. There's just the dating evidence for the deposition of that plough quarter. When we move into the monastic phase archaeology, we've got some interesting developments. We don't have any wonderful water mills of the type that Thomas was describing, but we do have structures that relate to the storage and conversion of rural surplus, including possibly the best example of a threshing barn from Middle Saxon England. This is dated to the 8th century, 20 metres long. What gives it away as a barn is the central aisle of posts. That's very distinctive, the barn structures. None on the continent at a similar period, but it has this a metal yard on the just immediately outside it that I've interpreted as a threshing floor. Pits found nearby contain dense concentrations of grain, burnt grain. That's just very provisionally we've had some of that grain examined. I haven't got time to go into the details, but Mark Cratcher from Oxford's been studied a subsample of that grain, and these are some of his preliminary conclusions. We also have quern manufacture attested on the site as well from the same period. Ironworking, as I mentioned previously in the charter records, is key to the workings of estates in pre-Viking Kent. We've got a very nice charter reference that tells us that ironwork, iron extraction rites were gifted to St. Augustine's in 689, but they were detached from the cause of Liminge, which I think historians agree probably is referring to the royal court of Liminge. So again, there was that pre-existing infrastructure in place. Ironworking, the extraction of iron, was key to the workings of that pre-existing royal estate. But interestingly, we see in the archaeological record clear evidence for, if you like, perhaps the intensification of that. Geophysics, in this point here, about 150 metres northwest of the monastic nucleus, produced all this noise, and on investigation, we've got extensive spreads of smithing and smelting slag in association with dated 8th, 9th century half pits. A very good parallel for some of the Irish monastic settlements where you've got ironworking up against monastic enclosures. Sort of evidence so far has been very, is it a premium in Anglo-Saxon England? Romney Marsh, this coastal salt marsh, is absolutely key to understanding the workings of the economy and rural exploitation at Liminge. And what our excavations have helped to do is shift the emphasis of analysis from supply networks, if you like, the mills, the fish traps and so forth, to the point of consumption. We can actually see these signatures, if you like, very clearly in the archaeological record. Here's just some of the charter sources recording the gift of land on Romney Marsh to the monastic community. We included here is the site of Santon. This is a known archaeological site that's produced evidence, Middle Saxon evidence for fishing, and also it was clearly engaged in international trade as well. So this is very likely a dependency that we can see active in terms of provisioning the monastic community. But if we examine the evidence, the faunal evidence from the excavations, masses of marine fishbone from those 8th to 9th century contexts, particularly strongly represented the larger marine species, cod and ling, followed by these other species. But these account for 35% of the hand-collected faunal assemblage. That's a huge contribution for a site of this period. It's very unusual. Interestingly, if one examines diachronic change, there is fishing happening in the 6th and 7th centuries, that pre-monastic phase, but it's on inshore catches, estuarine species, herring and flatfish. So this isn't something that's totally new and revolutionary, but what they're doing is they're exploiting the sea and the marine resources differently. They're catching line, they're going out into offshore waters. And that's interesting in light of some of the historical snippets that we get, and Wilfrid be telling us that Wilfrid taught the South Saxons how to use nets in terms of catching, taught them how to catch sea fish using nets. That's probably a bit of a literary topos going on there, but clearly there's a fundamental shift happening in the way that those marine species are being caught. And also, I should say that marine mollusks say exactly the same thing in terms of intensified use of those coastal resources. Also clear shifts in animal husbandry. That's what's shown very clearly in the analysis, the provisional analysis of the faunal remains. And the clear shift that one sees is from pig to sheep. Pig dominate, they're well up near 50% in the early Anglo-Saxon settlement focus, that pre-monastic phase. Nice archaeological corroboration for all the work that's been done on the exploitation of the weald, the pannage, you know, these great works by Whitney and Jolliffe and Everett to examine the transhumance patterns, arguing that that's fundamental to the whole kind of territorial structure of early Kent. We've got a nice pig assemblage from that early date to begin to examine their husbandry regime scientifically. But when we move into the 8th and 9th centuries, here we see this much greater emphasis on sheep husbandry, and one has to wonder whether that is taking place in those coastal salt marsh zones. And we hope to undertake isotope analysis on those remains. Gundula Muldner has pioneered a sort of approach which allows you to identify salt marsh signatures in grazing animals. So there's a potential to do that here. And undoubtedly, I think, as Pam Crabtree's work showing, this is all going towards secondary products in terms of the sheep production, principally wool. And we've got a wonderful array of textile manufacturing equipment from our 8th to 9th century deposits. Hundreds of loom weights such as this and other equipment. So just to sort of bring things to a close, some of the conclusions I come to from this brief review. I think Anglo-Saxon monastic archaeology so far has offered very much a craft-dominated perspective on technology as a tool of conversion. A limited understanding of how monastic foundations exploited existing systems of rural production, and a very small pool of archaeological evidence for tracking monastic impact on rural intensification, and that's really a disconnect with what the historical sources are telling us. I think the methodological implications here, we need to focus more on the precincts, on the outer precincts of known monastic communities, and they need to be targeted with intensive sampling regimes. Kent, I think, can offer something really a crucial perspective here, because it has this stability of pre-existing royal centres that are then monasticised. We can get that dynamic perspective that's lacking in other areas. And I think if we take Liminge, what it's shown, what our work has demonstrated, is that we've got these well-dated diachronic shifts that can really, you know, build upon Kent's capacity, tap into that capacity, for actually seeing a whole series of rural transformations linked to monastic foundation and Christianisation. And I think one of the lessons that it teaches us is that although there are important innovations, there's clear evidence for intensification, particularly in relation to those coastal resources, we shouldn't underestimate the capacity of pre-existing systems of rural production. And that's some of my references that I've used. Summary, there's already a very brief summary out, but there's something more extended, I'm impressed, that's going to appear in this year's Antiquaries Journal. And finally, if you want to know more about the project, please visit the website. Thank you.